Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Podcast time, one and only Fergie. Fergie has been on my radar since I was extremely young. He was somebody that I listened to on my radio growing up, and then watched DJ many times. And I've tracked his career over the years, and he's had a journey in the music industry that has gone all over the place in many weird and wonderful ways. And I recently got in touch with him, I think during COVID. We kind of reached out to each other, and I just thought it would be perfect for you all to listen to his story. I feel like there's people that listen to this podcast that will know parts about him that didn't know the history of him. I really enjoyed this conversation. I learned a lot, and I think you all will benefit massively from it. So without further ado, Fergie. Mr. Fergie, what's cooking, man?
What's happening, mate? Here we are.
How's it going?
Great. I had a really late night last night, and
what were you doing?
Really early. Talk to you.
I've been going to bed pretty late recently. During the weeks, I usually have this like really strict schedule where I wake up at like 6:37. I go to the gym, go to bed by like 11, like watch a bit of Netflix and like go to sleep. Where now, this week, I've been just going to bed at like 3 o'clock in the morning and waking up at like 8, and it's just been killing me.
Yeah, I go to bed when I was working last night, so it was really late. But if I'm not working, 9 o'clock, I'm in my bed.
Really?
Yeah.
It is truly old man time, isn't it? It's like,
it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. I love it. I get up really early. You know, I get up maybe 5:36.
Oh wow!
And the morning's a beautiful thing. You know, I love it. I love
You're it. In Vegas, right? As well.
I'm in Vegas. Yeah, 10 years I've been here, mate.
You're a brave man. You're a fucking brave man, son.
Let me tell you, Vegas has got nothing for me to be scared about after what I was like in the '90s. Vegas couldn't fucking clean my shoes. I'm safe.
I'm honestly just more about the heat. I can't handle that.
Oh yeah, the heat. It's only like maybe 2 months, mate. You know, it's maybe like 2 months of the year we are absolutely kind of cussing, and we can't like walk our dogs. You know, like I get up 5 a.m. We'll walk our dogs like 5 a.m. because the road's too hot.
Too hot, yeah. You have to get those little shoes for your dogs.
They have the shoes, mate. They have the shoes. They have the lot, you know. And it's like, it's even funny, you know, the looks that you get from people, and it's, they look at you, and they look at you sometimes, and like, these people think these are like fashion accessories, like, you know. It's like, you know, I've got like, one of my dogs is a Great Dane, he's huge.
Oh, no way. I love Great Danes.
Yeah, he's just like right there. And so he really, it really impacts his feet when he's out walking, you know. But when we put the shoes on him, oh my God, like, you want to see a dog do the zoomies? Like, he loves them, but he turns into like this fucking wonder horse. And you just have to contain him because he doesn't know his size. He'll run into you and bust your legs clean off. Like, you know,
Great Danes are amazing. They're huge.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. You need a big place and a big garden for them, though, because it's just...
They get walked two miles every day. They get walked, you know, every single day. And they just sleep all day. I've got a little bully mix, and they're like little and large, you know. Mm.
Yeah, I have
the Great Dane, the youngest, and the other one, the oldest. But everybody thinks the Great Dane is the little one's dad. Okay, cool.
Great Danes, when they're puppies, are like, it reminds you of Scooby-Doo. It's like they're just like, can't walk, can't do anything, fall over everywhere, knock over everything, but they're just so big.
Well, we had to take them from a family because they had this litter, huge litter, and they didn't want them. And we're like, okay, we'll take it.
Yeah.
We'll take one. And he was only 6 weeks old. Like, he was tiny. You're not meant to take large breed dogs from their mom until maybe 16, 20 weeks. And so 6 weeks was really young, and it wasn't, we didn't want to take them at that age, you know, but they were like,
just get rid.
They're just going to be put in the, you know, the dog pound. Like, okay, well, we don't want that. And we got our other guy from the dog pound. He was born in there. So his mom was, we wanted a pit bull, and his mom was a pit bull. So when we got this other little guy, he was 8 weeks old, and they said he was a pit bull, but
he's not. He's
definitely not a pit bull. He's not a pit bull. He has facial features of a staffy.
Okay.
He's long, like a dachshund. His little, if you picture Lord Farquaad, that's kind of like, it reminds me of
like a proper mutt. I love it. Just
he's a beautiful.
I'd love a dog here. Like, my parents have dogs back in the UK, but it's just me here, really. I have like housemates and they have a cat, but like, you can't look after a dog if you're touring everywhere unless you've got a partner or something like that.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard, especially like, you know, I mean, even when I was away for 5 weeks was the longest I've been away since I've been here 10 years. Yeah. When I've done that tour last September, and it's hard, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard. Like 5 weeks, but
How's, I want to go into the history, because I don't think you're ever going to remember this, and I love pulling this on people. But can you remember when the first time I don't think you actually even remember us ever meeting.
I don't.
I love this. Orange Corner in Ibiza.
Holy smoke.
I know. Wow.
Orange Corner was a good time.
So we met. You had like a weekly party there.
Kenya, yeah.
And I was 16 at the time, and I came out and played for Jamie Gittins. And then the year after, when I was 17, Robin Chapel was the resident. And then the year after that, you stopped doing the residency, but then I took on the residency when I was 18.
No way. Yeah.
So that was the first interaction. And then also the year I was resident was when Ruben Keeley was over and kind of was doing his little thing as well, aka Rebuke for anybody that's listening.
Yeah, Ruben, yeah. Wow, that's... I love hearing stuff like that. That's
a long time ago, man.
That have been
15 years ago.
Yeah, 2000.
No, longer than that. I was 16, so, and I'm 31 now, so 16 years ago.
God damn. That's mental.
That was your Radio 1 days.
Wow, Radio 1. Even that sounds like a million years ago.
I know, right?
And it was nearly a million years ago.
Yeah.
2007, I came off there. 2006. How many years ago was that?
Well, we're 2022 now.
Like 18 years, is it?
Yeah. That, 2006, I was 16.
Wow. That's a long time.
It's a long time. So I guess I know so much about your history. Because, like,
you can fill me in on some more.
Well, I don't know that much about your history, but like, I grew up listening to you on radio and kind of just being around. And I kind of want to go into that because I don't think many people know much about that. And I don't know if you know much about that by the sounds of it, but.
Whatever you want to ask, I'm it's all on the table, man.
So I kind of want to go back to the beginning. I know it's kind of cliche, but like I want to really kind of, I think a lot of people will really enjoy it if they kind of learn how it all started and kind of where your progression, because you've had a really, really interesting career, and it's kind of a career that isn't the usual route that DJs take and producers take, and I think it's really interesting, and I think it also goes to show that there's other ways into this industry than what the cliche ways at this moment in time to do, and I think people will learn from that.
Yeah it definitely has been a roller coaster.
Exactly, which I think I don't know if you agree with me on this, but all of our careers are a roller coaster. But because of social media and because of the way we and our teams kind of present ourselves, it looks like it's one straight line, and it's not. It never is. It's never one straight line to where you're at now. And I think a lot of people that come into the industry now and trying to be in the industry think that it's one straight line.
I think that's an incredible point. You know, the industry that they're even trying to be in is not even the industry for most part. You know, there's it's very kind of misinformed because a lot of people post all the nice stuff.
Exactly.
And it's a small part of it. You know, I'm not saying the rest isn't nice.
Yeah.
But the rest, there's a lot of work involved, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, a lot of rejection, and a lot of kind of soul searching. Because, you know, when I love the point you made in the Carnage interview, you know, you talked about the corporate world and the difference between the corporate world and kind of the world that we live in, and it's emotional. And I thought that was a beautiful point you made. And that really got me thinking as well. It was like 3 or 4 weeks you'd done that. I was like, wow, it's such an insight, you know, because often we all know we love music. We all know we listen to it with our hearts, but we don't often connect the kind of the dots in that same way that we are working in the business, you know what I mean? And you're making choices through the eyes of the young, excited DJ. You know what I mean? Exactly. And it may not be the right choice for your career long term, but you're like, oh, I just want to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing, you know? So, well, but that point you made was interesting.
No, because I think that's the thing is, like, I know you are 100% on with me with this, but, like, when you started DJing and producing and kind of doing your thing wherever you were, and then you have like a crew around you when you start, right? And then the crew kind of whittles down and falls off and goes get like they all get proper jobs, and then you find another crew and then they do the same. And it kind of, for a long time, and it was always me, like, with that one track mind of like, okay, this is where I need to get to. How the fuck do I get there? With everybody around me, although they're all still close friends of mine, but like all just giving in and going, fuck it, I need a real job. I want to pay my mortgage. I want to do all of that. People don't see that side of it.
Yeah. And part of you, if you're being honest, I know certainly with me, you know, part of the way through my career, part of me was thinking, fuck, I wish I could do a real job. Yeah. I wish that, you know, what would it be like? I've never done a real job in my life. Mm. I started teaching in 1992.
Wow.
You know, I've never had that. You know, I remember sitting on the beach, you know, being absolutely wasted, crying my eyes out and being very lonely and very sad and touring the world. And I always used to call my mom and, you know, I'm like, you know, I wonder if I could be like, do like forklifting. That would be,
yeah.
I'd like to do something like that, you know, just because again, the kid and me getting to drive something around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Happy days. But yeah, obviously the desire to be a DJ has never left me, or if it has, not left me for long, regardless of the music.
Yeah. You know?
Sometimes it's been the music that's been the force that's got me into the DJ booth, because for many years I found it hard being in there.
Yeah.
You know? But it's always been the joy of DJing, and that's what's kept me. Yeah, like 30 years this year. It's a long time.
It's a long time, man. 1982 then. Start DJing.
92.
I was going to say 82. That's fucking, you're old then. You're not that old.
92. I've still got my original stuff here.
Have you really?
That's my turntables I bought.
Wow.
1200s. Yeah. That mixer Tony gave me. Tony DeVee, obviously. Mm. Changed my life. He gave me that on Christmas Day, 1996. That was his mixer. It was the first Newmark mixer they brought out with the sampler. Yeah. And it was like, oh my God, this is, there's nothing, you know, I've had all the material things you could want in your life. I've had it all. I've lost them. And, you know, the only two things I've ever kept is my turntables and the mixer. You know, it's the only things that I've traveled.
I think that's a kind of given that you're never going to get a proper job, mate.
Because
that's the first thing that everyone sells. It's the first thing that everyone sells. I haven't really had a DJ setup at home for years, and I've recently just got one. But during COVID, I found my old decks. I used to have the Stanton STR 8150s.
Yes, yeah.
And I had to chuck them out because they stopped working. But yeah, it is so nice just to like see the old setup again and be like, fuck yeah, I'm a DJ.
You know, and you know what's nice for me is, you know, I used to polish these every Sunday. I took the needle head off, you know, I took all the weights off, and I polished them every Sunday, the mixer, you know, and I used to, you know, clean all my records. And it was just that passion that we had, you know, that obviously is there in different ways now. You know, I'm certainly not polishing them every Sunday night. Sorry. But, you know, it's that passion, that excitement that you had when you were starting, you know, you're starting off and you're so excited, but you've only got three records in your record collection. You know what I mean? And you can't mix any of them.
And you listen to them over and over again. Just like, so wear depressing. Them out. Yeah.
So depressing. Like, my very first turntables were the all-in-one coffin.
Okay, yeah.
Turntable. The Cloud Nines, they were called. And it just had a little slot for a light.
Yeah.
It had two faders. It had speed control was 33 and 45 BPM. I had the rip apart of my cigarette box. to put it in so they get a little bit of speed variation. Not that it helped. The only thing I could do was do a spin back and then put the other track on.
Yeah.
Every time you're on a spin back, the belt came off and you had to get the platter off and put the elastic band back on. You had to start again.
That's belt driven for you.
Yeah, phenomenal. But phenomenal experiences.
Yeah.
You know? And didn't have a clue what we were playing back then. Mm. You know, like I'm playing Moby records at, you know, 45 and they should be 33. Like just all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, trying to figure out how to connect all this stuff, you know, because all you're listening to is DJ mixtapes.
Yeah, working out.
Back then, I was like, yeah, it was like the hardcore rave. I was big into Coxie.
Yeah, the little like plastic. Can you remember the plastic folders you would get? And you'd like open them up and there'd be like four tapes in there.
Yeah. Helter skelter, like all of it. Yeah.
Have you seen that meme when it's a tape cassette and a pencil and it says, you know, you're old if you know the relationship between a pencil and a tape?
100%. There was many of hands and head moment. And
yeah.
Like, wow. But them moments were incredible. You know, it's like we really had, you know, and I think maybe that's what people miss out on a bit today.
Yeah.
Like, even by holding that tape or holding that record, you felt that was your wee slice of the scene.
Mm.
You were a part of it because you had this. You know, it was a beautiful thing. And it was like, you know, it's all worn out and you're passing it around your friends and they're like, did you hear that? Did you hear that? Ooh. You know, and it's, and I think that part of the joy for me anyway, would be, you know, you hear only just playlists and stuff like that now, and you're not, it's just a little bit different, right?
I think the value of music has gone down massively, and I think there's pros and cons to the streaming services, but I think by the digital era has devalued music to a wild level where it's so throwaway, where the consumer doesn't realize how much effort goes into it purely because of the way it's delivered to them. And when we used to buy vinyl, even CDs, like for me, like I grew up in the CD era as well. And like buying your CD, like with the hard earned money and like putting it into your CD player at home. And I would literally sit in my bedroom and just listen to the same CD. Like, I feel sorry for my parents because they listen to so much garbage. But it's like you just had that physical form. And I think like the artwork, I remember like reading and studying the artwork and like the like pulling the cover out and like open it up, and then there's like a poster or there's something else or there's the lyrics. And it's like you don't get that nowadays with what we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was definitely that kind of emotional, more of, and I don't want to say more because I'm always kind of, you know, especially when I came to Vegas, I had to look at who I was and what I'd done in a different way.
Totally.
You know, it was like I had to look at the scene as a different thing. You know, I had to actually, when I came here, transport myself back in time and look at it like, okay, how can I look at this scene in Vegas with a fresh mind, when look at a lot of these new people that are coming to Vegas as grassroots, and look at them and think, this is their first time in a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
I need to remember how I felt the first time I was in a nightclub. And it's the same thing for them. So my point in that is I try, and I forget sometimes, but I try and remember, okay, not to say that it was better when I was younger or better now, but just try and point out maybe the differences in what we got from it. And like you're saying, like, you know, you had the more of an emotional connection to like the CDs that we bought that we had in our possession. And you know, the kids today don't really have that, but they also don't want that.
Well, exactly. And I think this is the thing, is like it's easy for us to be like sound like old men going, oh, it was better back in our day, but these kids, the classic example for me is Can you remember growing up and your parents listening to music and you'll be like, what the fuck are they listening to? And they're talking about them, that music is like the fucking dog's bollocks.
Yeah.
Where, and then we do the same thing about music back from the 90s.
Totally.
And the kids will look at us and go, what the fuck are they listening to?
Because it's actually... produced-wise, it's the worst music on earth, but that's why it's so beautiful. It's like there's nothing's EQ'd. It's yeah. like the singing. I let my wife read. She's like, that singer's like not even in key. And I'm like, and you know, it's just kind of, it's all over the place in a certain way. And I had this conversation with Shadow Child, and what he. Because what he brought out and the realization he had was when producers were making records in the early 90s,
yep.
and it sounded like there was maybe three different breakdowns in these records. Mm-hmm. So Shadow Child was like, well, the reason it sounds like that is because these producers were listening to mixtapes,
yeah.
and they're making records based on what they thought the record was on the mixtape, but it wasn't, it was a mix.
Wow. I never even thought of that.
Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Yeah.
So you're listening to Coxie, you're like, okay, this breakdown, bum, 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 and then you have a totally different hook yeah. for another breakdown, and it's a fucking mix. But these rave records, they didn't
wow,
know.
I never even thought of that.
They didn't know, and I was like, wow, yes, that's what it is. And it's like, I always just thought, okay, a guy's going into the studio in his bedroom, you know, he's came up with all these different sounds and he's like, okay, there's three tracks here, but fuck it. Like, I'm just so excited. I'm going to put it all into one track. Hopefully somebody will play it. Because we've all been in the studio and we come up with something, we try and sometimes fit it all into the same track. And I was talking to Shadow Child about it, Simon, and he said that and I was like,
yeah, wow.
That's what it was. That's what it was.
Never
you know, they
that.
Were so listening to these mixes and just not understanding that it was different records. And yeah, and it just shows you the connection and how that even took our scene from the DJ. How important is the DJ?
Yeah,
because the mix creating a different vibe is so important, you know, and it just shows again, highlights again the role of the DJ putting music together.
Because for a long time, the DJ wasn't about the DJ.
Yeah.
When it started, it was just about people escaping.
What
can you remember when it became about the DJ?
I mean, I think when it was really not about the DJ, if you look at a lot of old footage,
yeah.
you know, if you look at the early kind of raves, late 80s, And the interesting thing about that is people aren't even dancing in groups. They're dancing on their own.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their own style of clothes. They're all wearing different stuff. Okay, everybody might be wearing a Stussy t-shirt and stuff like that, but they're all got their own little twist on it.
Yeah.
And no one's facing the DJ.
No.
You know, it was really kind of early 90s, where people, it really changed from the old footage that I've watched anyway, you know.
Have you seen the documentary Maestro
no.
about New York? I'll send it to you.
Oh, I have. It's on Resident Advisor.
Oh, is it?
The Resident Advisor producer or something.
No,
like that.
It's like a super old documentary on the new on like the power. I'll send it to you like anyway, but that was late 80s that it kind of came out, and it was like Paradise Garage, The Loft. It was based on all of the New York, and back then it I feel like that's when it was like Larry Levan and Frankie and all of those guys where
Dylan Mancuso.
Yeah, when it first started to like their names first started to be like, oh, we're gonna go see this person. I think that took time for people to be like, I have to go and watch this person DJ. I think it was before like, we're just going to this party because we know it's gonna be great music and we can just be ourselves. Were you ever in the free raving days? Did you ever used to go free partying
So I got the tail end of that. Yeah. You know, like 1991 was when I first started going to like school discos and taking acid, and you know,
You were taking acid at school?
Well, I was selling acid at school. So I left school when I was 12.
Jeez, son.
Yeah, it was good times. So I caught the tail end of it. So in Belfast, it was like free raves in this place called Crumlin up in the country. And one of my friends used to take me up there. He's an older man, Davy Thompson. He used to take me up there. And
what was it like growing up in Belfast then?
Oh, man, unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was beautiful, you know. It was scary. You know, I'm a Protestant. I grew up in a Protestant neighborhood.
Yeah.
Back then, people didn't really... Catholics, Protestants didn't really mix that much.
No.
But the raves was the first place
they did
that I seen that happen.
Yeah.
You know, the first rave I went to was Carl Cox.
Wow.
At Hellraiser. And it was a bomb scare. Everybody had to get out. He said there had been a bomb planted in there. Everybody had to get out. We all got kicked out. I had a rap speed in me and a half a trip. And I'm like, what the fuck's going on? Everybody has to get out. Everybody's panicking. We go outside. Everybody's dancing on top of the armored cars. Jesus. I don't know if you've been to Belfast. You've been to Belfast.
Yeah.
You've seen the armored cars in Belfast. Everywhere. You know, that's just how they roll. Everybody's dancing on top of them. People have got their car stereos on. The music's pumping. And we didn't think we were going to get back in. And a couple of hours later, they let us back in. Guy comes on the microphone, Stefano, Belfast, this is the moment you've all been waiting for. Make some noise for Carl Cox. Oh my God, that moment.
Man, I just got goosebumps, literally.
Unbelievable. And it's like, you know, everybody's hands in the air, you know what I mean? Glue bags, and, you know, they got their glue bag in one hand. Brilliant. But, you know, they were the moments that were kind of really seen unison, and, and, you know, everybody loves each other when they're on the. On the E's,
yeah.
As soon as the E's wear off, everybody's out. But Belfast was beautiful. It was scary, you know, especially for people of my age, because we didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah,
you know, I never hated Catholics. I had Catholic friends, and you know, but it was just an overall thing that was kind of lingering around. And I was fortunate I didn't get caught up in it.
Yeah.
I left home when I was 14, first of all.
Did you leave Ireland when you were...
I left Ireland when I was 16, but I left my hometown, Larne, and went to Belfast when I was 14.
Yeah.
And I used to play in this place in Belfast. I was DJing, I was playing this place on a Saturday night. And at the end of the night, they would all come marching in with the flags, all the regalia, everything. And I had to play God Save the Queen, and you had to stand up straight.
Really?
And it was very scary, very scary place, because very, very serious.
Yeah.
You know,
People have died. A lot of fucking people have died because of that.
A lot of people have died, you know. A lot of people have, a lot of heartache, you know. And, you know, and I don't want to play it down in any way, because obviously it's a huge part of our culture, both sides. And ultimately, we're all one. And that buzz that it gave us and the release it gave us when we went to the raves, I would not want to grow up anywhere else.
No.
It was an unbelievable. Our culture back home, you couldn't fucking, you just, there's nothing like it.
I still feel there's something with Ireland now, with that same, it still lingers in the air, and Irish rave harder than anyone.
I think so.
Like,
I think so.
No, they do. It's like, I've only played a few shows over there, and every time that it's something very special.
They're just mad bastards, man.
Yeah.
I like, I've been everywhere. You know, not, I haven't been everywhere. I've been lucky enough to travel
a lot of places around. Yeah.
And, you know, I've never... I've never seen anywhere like back home, but there's kind of Belfast and Glasgow, and that is like, holy fuck. I mean, if you kept the club open for a week,
they would still be
motherfuckers
there.
Would be like, no problem.
I've never played in Glasgow. No. I've always wanted to, but I've never played.
Beautiful place. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Like, huge fucking history in this game. Like, you know, huge. I don't know how long, like, Colour's 27 years I've been going. Pressure.
Yeah.
Fuck knows how long that's been going. Mm. I mean, Slam, Orden, the guy's just been...
killing. It's interesting because Belfast and Glasgow, for me, I've been to Glasgow and obviously Belfast, they're very similar cities. There's struggle there. And I find even, like, I live in Detroit and there's struggle here. Like, you feel it walking around and you see it. And I find cities that struggle, that have been through it, like, their parties are just always the best.
It's raw. Yeah. It's raw emotion, man, you know?
Well, I think it is 100% that. And it's also, it's like, they have a reason to escape. They need to escape their everyday life. And I'm not saying that everybody that lives in Belfast, everyone that lives in Glasgow, everyone that lives here has a shit life. It's not the case. But they're depressing cities. But with a depressing city becomes so much joy and happiness on the underbelly of the city. And it kind of brings communities together.
Yeah, I mean, they've changed a lot. You know, Belfast and Glasgow are very vibrant now. There's a lot of new industry, a lot of new business coming into these places.
I mean, more about the history, because that I feel like the history of these cities just will always be there, and it will always underline everything.
Harsh places to be. You know, in Belfast, you couldn't even really go into the city centre. You know, I remember as a kid, my mum would say, you know, like, bombs going off all the time. You know, when I did go to school for that short period of time, I'd come home and you would be watching the news and be shootings every day.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, my mum's friend who was dating a Catholic was a taxi driver, and, you know, he was in the taxi rank and someone just went up and
blew it off.
You know, so there's been loads of that stuff, and that's where the emotion comes from. That, you know, it's like living in real kind of crazy life, you know, and that's really has always come through in the music from the 90s, I would say, because once the drugs came in place, that was the connector for everybody. Totally. That was the connector. Before that, I haven't read anything about any kind of, you know, people being... having a togetherness, you know. So it was definitely the Big E's played a part in it.
I totally agree, and I'm not one to tell people to go get fucked up every weekend, but it is. It brought everyone together, and it built a community that we all eat from nowadays. Because it's not necessarily like that so much now. There's other things, and it's kind of, but it's grown an industry that's allowed us all to have the best job in the world.
Exactly. Listen, and I'm not advocating for people to take drugs, totally. Either, but it's important to give things their place and time and their importance and stuff like that. And it was a godsend then. I don't give a fuck. It was a godsend then. Totally. It really was like opening a fucking, I don't want to say a tube of glue, because I'm not talking about sniffing it. Yeah, well, there's plenty of that going on as well. But, you know, getting people together and just getting people, just kind of release the kind of tension.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because everybody loves everybody, really. You know, it's like, just get caught up and stuff.
Well, I think this is the thing, and it's like, without going too deep, it's like, you see what's going on in the world right now, and you're just like, fuck's sake, like, why can't people just fucking get along? Just accept, like, not just Ukraine, just everything. It's just like, there was a time where everything feels extremely sensitive right now, and... For me, you just need to fucking go and rave. Just get out and just be with people and just like, just enjoy meeting people and experience different people and listening to music and just chill the fuck out.
Yeah, totally. You know, like really just fucking be present, man. Yeah. And just, you know, try and be you and,
yeah,
you know, remember the next person's trying to be them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They're not trying to be you. They're trying to be them. So yeah, don't fucking, you know, you don't know what the fuck's going on in their life. You don't know what's going on. You don't know what they're trying to get over. They don't know what you're trying to get exactly over. Just let people be themselves, man. You know, it's like we're all figuring this out.
Yeah.
Fuck, I've been DJing 30 years. I've been in this scene 30 years and I'm still discovering things that are fucking mind-blowing for me. Mind-blowing for me. You know, discovering that the scene doesn't owe me jack fucking shit.
Nothing.
You know, but for many years, having a chip on my shoulder, I've done this and what, you know, I've done blah, 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 blah. You know, it was like a gig last year in Vegas. I couldn't even get my name on the flyer.
Yeah.
I couldn't get my name on the flyer. It was a techno event here. And I said, I was fucking sad as fuck.
Yeah.
Because we grew up, the biggest thing is, mate, when you're, you want to get your name on the flyer.
Oh, 100%.
It's such a big thing. And I'm saying to my wife, I don't think I'm going to do this gig. I kind of feel like I've been given a slap in the face.
Mm.
She said, why? I said, fuck, I've been DJing fucking nearly 30 years. And I'm fucking 13 essential mixes. I've been on radio one for 6 years. I've done all, I'm reeling all this shit off I've done.
Yeah.
Right? And she goes, well, what does that tell you? What do you mean? What does that tell me? She says, doesn't matter, love. It's like, fuck.
It's fucking killer, that. So
but it
true
was beautiful. Yeah, it no, made it me is feel so light.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, you're right. And it gave me, it put me like that. It put me back in a position where if you ever asked me, and if I was talking to young DJs and producers, and they would ask me, what's the most enjoyable part of your career? I always said to them, the most enjoyable part of my career is the beginning. When you're trying to get your foot on the ladder, when you're trying to get your name on the flyer,
yeah,
you're hungry as fuck,
yeah,
and nothing can beat that feeling. And here's me last year thinking, here I am nearly 30 years into this, able to experience that again, yeah, where I have to try and climb up again. And I'm like, I'm a lucky bastard.
Yeah. No, I love that.
And
it's also you're trying to grow up in the scene again, but with all the knowledge you have from your previous, which is something that when you first started out, if you knew all of that knowledge, you would be in a different stratosphere.
And I'm glad that I didn't know it. I couldn't change anything. Fucking hell. As I said, I've had it all. I've lost it all.
Mm.
I've fucked a lot of shit up,
yeah,
and loads of scars, beautiful scars. I'm fucking more proud of my scars than anything else.
I love that.
You know, it's like I look back at stuff and think, fucking hell, I'm still going.
Mm.
I'm still trying. You know, it's like I said to myself, I'm living the dream. What's the dream? All I wanted to be when I was a kid was a DJ.
Yeah.
I'm a DJing. I'm still DJing.
It's amazing.
Trying to figure it out.
It's a really hard thing to do when you're in it, is to self-assess your situation in life. And I can only speak for myself, but I've had it multiple times in my career where you're just like, why the fuck is this not working? Why the fuck is this not working? Why am I not in that lineup? Why is my record not going to be put number one? Why is Spotify not getting this record? Why is this happening? Why are they getting booked? Why am I only earning this much money? Blah, 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 blah. And then you catch yourself in the mirror going, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. That's not an excuse to not work harder. And that's not an excuse to stop doing what you're doing and wanting more and having that drive to be more and do more. But there's a level of where you have to be like, I'm doing it. And some people it takes 10 days and some people it takes 1,000 days.
Yeah. And it's you have to have the drive. You have to have the passion. You know, it's like going back to that gig that I didn't get on the flyer for. It was with Rufus the Soul last year.
Yeah.
And I get it. I've played that many different styles of music. Some people were like, is Ferg going to play EDM here? Is he going to play fucking pop? Is he going to play techno? Well, is he going to play hard house? Well, what's he going to play?
Yeah.
Does his name fit our brand? It doesn't fit everybody's brand.
Yeah.
That's fine. At some point, I have to turn around to myself and look at the mirror and go, okay, am I doing this for my ego? Am I doing this for to grow my DJ business? Or am I going to do this because I just want to be a DJ and I want to be in that environment and I want to play that music?
Yeah.
Okay, this is one of them instances where I get to go in this club. I'm not on the flyer. Nobody knows me. Mm. Nobody wants to fucking know me. I get to go in here. I've got no pressure, you know, and I went on at 4 a.m. and they normally close the club at 5 o'clock and they all stayed until 7 a.m. It's the longest the club's ever been open. And there's people standing in front of me with things on her phone going, who are you? And I'm like, if I had had my name on the fire, I would never been able to have this beautiful moment.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
Here we are a year later and I'm doing the same gig again. And I'm not on the flyer. I don't even want to be on the flyer.
Yeah.
I'm doing the exact same set and I'm like, this is beautiful. Mm. This is fucking brilliant.
It's amazing. You know what I mean? But I guess also, if you were in that situation 10 years ago, do you think you as yourself would be able to process it how you processed it a couple of years ago?
I don't know. Me, like, a lot of this kind of asking different questions came through COVID.
Mm.
Like, me and my wife lost everything through COVID. You know, 2019 was going to be the year. Like, my contract for 2019 was the most money I would have earned in 1 year in my whole career.
Yeah.
I didn't earn any of it.
Yeah.
Like, each year I've been here, it's been on a contract basis. Mm-hmm. And we decided to build this huge house. It took us 2 years. It was our dream home. Mm-hmm. We were going to stay there. And the studio I had was fucking unbelievable. It was like your dream. I had the huge Moog modular. Wow. I had everything.
Yeah.
And we fucking had to get rid of everything.
Yeah.
Went and lived in a caravan, mate.
Yeah.
Went and lived in a caravan. You know, because our life changed like that in 3 weeks. And I was the happiest fucking man. I was so happy.
Wow.
And everybody's saying to me, why are you so happy? I was like, I was finding it really hard being in the clubs. You know, since I came here 10 years ago, I was doing 225 shows a year.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Playing the EDM stuff, you know. So playing that music, you know what? When I came here because I got to the ceiling where I could get in the techno world. There was a part where I could get to and the gatekeepers were just not having it anymore.
Yeah.
They're like, Fergie, you're...
Fuck off.
This is as far as you're going, mate, you know? And so that's why I decided to come here. I was tired, you know? I was doing 15, 20 flights a month playing in every hole in the hedge.
Yeah.
You know, clubs all around the place, but they weren't the clubs that I needed to be in.
Totally.
Like, you know, I wasn't getting into your cocoons. I wasn't getting into, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff like that. I'd gone from earning thousands of fucking pounds to going and playing in Pressure in Glasgow for $500.
Yeah.
Just to get in there.
Yeah.
So my life had changed dramatically. And
was this still when you were doing Radio 1?
This is after Radio 1.
Okay.
You know, Radio 1, that kind of came to an end because, you know, they got me into the office and they were like, you got to go back to Hard House.
Yeah.
And 2003, I started really playing all techno on the show. You know, it really became the main output for techno.
So when did you start Radio 1?
2001.
And that was with Hard House?
That was with Hard House. That's what got me in there. Yeah, that was what I was doing right then. Before that, you know, they approached me and asked me and Carl Cox to be the first ever resident DJs of the Essential Mix.
Yeah.
So that for me blew my head because obviously Carl was one of the first guys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay, cool. Amazing. But that's what got me in the door was the Essential Mixes. Then they offered me Danny Rampling's show, which blew my mind even more. And I remember reading a comment. It was like when the message boards first started.
Yeah.
Which was hard as fuck to read.
I bet.
If people were writing it, it meant it was true because our minds didn't really know anything. It was so new to us.
It's still the case now.
I don't fucking bother about that stuff now. Like, what I found from the hardship of them early days, the message boards, like one of the comment that stuck in my mind was when they got rid of Danny Rambling and gave me a show was, why exchange a Ferrari for an Escort? I love that. But the stuff I used to get, especially with all the Tony stuff, you know, Tony was dying of HIV and people were like, fucking, you know, fuck, hope Fergie dies and fucking, you know, because I changed from Hard House. I stopped playing Hard House.
Yeah.
And they fucking hated me. Mm. So it's like the techno people hated me because I was trying to be techno. The Hard House people hated me because I fucking didn't want to be Hard House. And I'm just in here in limbo, getting absolutely wasted off my head, playing the all my friends that were in the DJ booth because everybody else fucking hated me at one point.
Jesus.
You know, and it's like, oh my God, what the fuck?
That's a head fuck.
It was fucking, it was so hard, man.
Yeah.
It was so hard. And still being a kid, like it was fucking 2021, you know, like I went in that top 100 DJ thing at 7 or 8. At that age, there was nobody that broke through that golden circle of Danny Tenaglia, Paul Oakenfold, Bad Boy Slim, Carl Cox, Sasha, Digweed, Diva Morales, Frank, like all these DJs.
And you.
And then there's me. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be fit to tie these guys' fucking shoes. I couldn't tie, you know what I mean? Like, these guys are like, wow. I remember going to the fucking the Ericsson Music Awards, and I was in the category of Best International DJ for Danny Tenaglia, you know. And I had that cover out, mixed my cover out with me lying in the bath.
Yeah.
And Tenaglia goes, yeah, man, I got your CD cover on my fridge. I'm like, fucking hell.
Jesus.
Just mad shit.
Yeah.
You know, mad shit.
So you were in your 20s then?
20, yeah.
Damn. Mm-hmm. How did that start? So I like the correlation from where did the Radio 1 thing start? I know we're jumping around a bit, but you moved to England when you were 16?
I met Tony when I was 15. I was DJing in Northern Ireland, and I met him. I'd been buying his records and stuff. I was playing in a place in Antrim, and every time Tony played, I was like, I'm not fucking taking the night off to go and see any fucker. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? I'm doing my gig.
Yeah.
And the third time he played, I was like, I gotta go and fucking see him. It just released 99 Floor Elevators Hooked.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, I gotta go and see this guy. And went and seen him and pestered him all night, got his phone number while he's DJing, changing records. I'm like, give me your phone number. I'm like 15. And then after his gig, most of the gigs back then in Northern Ireland, they were all in hotels.
Yeah.
So you would do the gig and then they would go up to their hotel room. So after the gig, I carried Tony's record boxes. I got up in this hotel room because he's just chilling out there before he gets his flight back to London because he's going to play Trade. And I'm talking to him and blah, 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 blah. And I'm telling him how long I've been DJing. And he says, oh, I see a lot of myself in you. He's just saying all this stuff, being nice. I take my T-shirt off. I'd been in a bad car crash and my ribs are all fucked up.
Yeah.
I take the T-shirt off and grab his hand, start trying to get him to feel my chest. He pulls his hand away and all this fucking shit. I didn't know he was gay, like. I had no idea he was fucking gay. So he's obviously fucking sat in there going, holy fuck, I'm like this fucking 15-year-old guy's fucking trying to crack onto me in the hotel room. I had no idea. Anyway, Tony goes to the airport. I go back into the little after party underneath the stairs in the hotel. And I walk in and they're all like, whoa, here comes Fergie the faggot mag. I had no clue what they were talking about. No clue. Like, I never met any gay people. There's just wasn't any gay people where I came from that we knew about. It was just a very, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I just didn't know. And then I used to phone Tony 3 times a day, every day for like a year. And he answered the phone every single time. Some cunt fucking told me back in the day, if you have like a of the old phone with the button on it.
Yeah.
If you do like 10 zeros, then you dial in the number. The call doesn't cost anything. And I was doing that every day. Then all of a sudden I hear, Robert, get down these fucking stairs. What the fuck is that? It's a fucking phone bill with fucking Tony's number on it.
Oh, that's so good.
Anyway, and he invited me over to stay, come over for a holiday. Mm. This was on his, I remember him answering the phone one time. He said, you can't come. I was like, why? He says, it won't look very good. You know, you're so young, blah, 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 blah. I was like, no, I'm definitely coming. Like, I was spoken to my mum and dad and all that, blah, blah, blah. I'm definitely, he was like, you can't come. I'm a poof, and put the phone down. So he did. And then his friend called me up, and Alex, and he explained everything to me, and we kind of put it on hold for a bit. Then every time Tony came over to Ireland to play, then he started staying at my mum and dad's house.
Ah, okay.
And he got to know my mum and dad, and then he actually signed to be my guardian.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, so then I went to England for a week, and it was 1996, and it was during the ceasefire.
Yeah.
And the ceasefire broke while I was in England.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Tony, looking at the news and stuff, was quite worried about it, and he was like, you know, if you want to stay, I'll look after you. And yeah. I was like, still coming home. Yeah. And that was that journey, you know, and I remember it was 20th of June 1996. I went over there, and you know, that week we'd done I think 78 gigs in that week. Tony used to do that every week. You know, I got fucking arrested in the lead mill in Sheffield for fucking making Tony a bomb of speed out in the car. Obviously, he sent me out to the car to get the fucking, he always would take a wee bit of speed, you know, he's doing that many gigs. I'm sat in the fucking passenger seat of his car, getting speed out, got the fucking glove box open, got the rizzle of paper, making it up. Some cunt opens the fucking car door and they flash the warrant card. I was like, oh, fuck. They say to me, what's that? I go, and I don't even know where I got this word from. They say, what's that? And I said, glucose. So they search the car. They get me out of the car. They don't even lock Tony's car. They don't go into the club and tell Tony that they've taken me. They take me to the police station. They're like, how did we know you're saying, like, how do we know you who you are? Who you're saying you are?
Yeah.
I'm like, phone my mom. So they phone my mom. Hello, is your son here? What's his name? And blah, 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 blah. And they obviously couldn't arrest me because I was only 16.
Yeah.
You know, so then they eventually told Tony, and he came after the gig, and he has to come in all angry. Why are you taking drugs? You're getting sent straight home and all this fucking shit. You know, and I'm like, fuck me, man. You know what I mean? Sticking up for you here, Nick. And yeah, got into the car, and he's like, oh, thank you so much. Blah, 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 blah. And then we get we still had like Progress and Derby to do. We had Moneypenny's in Birmingham to do, and we had Trade in London to do. So it was like this whole. So my introduction, basically, sorry for going all around the place.
No,
I love it. English scene was that week where it was just like
everywhere,
mad shit going around with fucking Tony DeVee, who was at his peak at that time, and it was just.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
16 years old.
Yeah, man. That's special.
Like, fuck. Wow. Fuck. Mental.
So did you start doing the rounds as well then?
Tony started getting me gigs, and then it very quickly had to stop, you know, because it wasn't going down well.
Yeah.
I was doing like Miss Money Pennies and Cream, and it wasn't going down well. There's a lot of backlash, and Tony was like,
what type of backlash?
Just haters, you know. Yeah. Understandably, you know, there have been a lot of local guys who've been applying their fucking craft for years and years, and then here comes this little Irish twat, like, yeah, you know, supposedly sucking on Tony's cock.
Yeah.
Or whatever, getting these gigs. And I understand it, you know. Right. Even at the time, I understood it because Tony explained to me, yeah, why I needed to understand it. And he said, this is going to stop because it's not going to do you any favors. Mm. Like, if I keep doing this, like, the promoters are, yes, they're going to keep booking you, but it's not going to work. So I actually did get a real job. I got a real job for 6 months. Mm. And I was packing nuts and bolts, and I was getting like £60 a week in my fucking bed set. I'd left Tony's house at this, yeah, point as well. I was living, yeah, in a bed set. It's £40 a fucking week. So fucking £20 a week to myself. And them times were hard. Like, it wasn't even electric in the bed set. You know, there was nothing like that. So great time growing up, you know. It was a big learning curve, and but it was essentially, you know, Tony was a lot older than me. He knew what had to happen. I had already been DJing quite a lot of years from before I went to England, but it was a new scene for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I almost had to earn my stripes.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, it was beautiful. It was a beautiful thing. And then I did start getting gigs on my own. You know, I wasn't in the main room. I was doing the back rooms and stuff like that. And the next big gig Tony did give me was Gatecrasher at the Republic.
Yeah.
And he fucking didn't even tell me about it. We were in Gatecrasher at the Republic, and Tony was playing 4 till 6, and he had to be in London for his set at Trade. Fuck me. The last 30 minutes, he came up to me and goes, "You're playing the last half an hour. I've saved you all the best records." And he fucking had a wee pile of records for me. I'm fucking like, holy fuck. Couldn't believe it. So I had to go on, and it was the best ever gig I had at the Republic.
I was going to say, how was that?
Incredible. Yeah. Incredible, because there was no expectation, you know, and it was just like, I was just this kid, and it was the best gig I ever had at the Republic. I never really went down that well at the Republic, you know, Gatecrasher. Mm. It was more of a trans crowd, you know. One of a funny story I'll tell you, actually, it just comes to mind when Tony. So Sunday Central, you remember Sunday Central?
No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, Sunday Central in Birmingham was the most hedonistic kind of Sunday party, and
okay,
must have been the world at that time. It was like, there would be people walking around with basketball nets and just dressed up as all sorts of things. This guy always used to bring a toilet into the fucking nightclub. It was, and just used to sit on it on the dance floor. And it was like, and there was this group of people that came and brought these sleeping bags. And if they didn't like a DJ, they would get in a sleeping bag on the dance floor and just fucking
go to sleep.
How bad is that? I'm not even going to mention the DJ. They've done it too continually. But,
why, the DJ still around?
Still around to this day. Yeah. Oh, still around to this day. Yep. Very famous guy as well. But this other time, they asked me to play at Sunday Central. Mm. It's my first time. And the lineup was me, Tony DeVee and John Kelly.
Yeah.
So I'm like, fucking brilliant. And I'm going on and I'm fucking banging the arse clean out of it. Like, and
were you playing hard house then?
Not only was I playing hard house then, this is fucking hilarious. And it's a testament to how big Tony's heart was.
What? Go on.
I was playing all Tony's records before he went on. Because I was, for me, it was a sign of respect. I'm like, Tony, that I'm playing always. And he never once said to me, Ferg, what are you doing, mate? I was 16. Like, he's like, he never once said to me, what are you doing? And I'm just like puppy eyes, like, fucking, yeah, 99 floor elevators, yeah.
I love that.
And I'm playing all these songs, and I'm so excited to finish, because I'm going to get, like, I want to get off my head, take a couple of pills, and just fucking get clean on it. Tony comes in, and fucking, oh, good job, blah, 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 blah. Straight on the dance floor, straight in front of the DJ booth, couple of pills in my, off my fucking head, fucking loving it, blah, blah, blah. Tony calls me into the DJ booth a couple of hours later. I'm fucking... and it's loud as fuck in there. And I go into the DJ booth and he says something to me. And I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. But for some reason, I thought he said to me, look at this fucking DJ booth. He's pointing, you know, at the where all the records and stuff are. Mm. And I'm thinking, look at this here, you know, fucking tidy up. You fucking look at the mess you've left from when you were playing. So I'm fucking off my head. I go up to the bar and I get this bar, you know, a bar mat,
tile.
And I fucking put some water on it and I'm cleaning the DJ booth and I'm taking all the glasses and bottles and I'm taking them out of the DJ booth. And emptying the ashtray and all that. Absolutely wasted. Tony turns down the monitors and goes, what the fuck are you doing? I said, you told me to clean the DJ booth. He said, no. I told you, get your records out. You're on next. John Kelly's cancelled. I'm like,
oh shit. Believe it.
My chin. They introduced me. They tell everybody that the fucking John Kelly wasn't going to be here. And I'm stood there with the promoter. And I'm fucking still a guy there. And he grabs my hand to put my hand in the air. And my chin's like, it was unbelievable, mate. It was one of the best gigs. And I remember every record I put on, I had to fucking bend down like behind the DJ booth just to
close
myself. Like, it was just...
I love that.
It was...
Could you imagine doing that now?
Mad times. And that's like, you know, going back to that point you touched on about the emotion and about the business. And at that point, there was no thinking about it as a business.
No. It was still so young. It was still such a young industry.
Yeah.
It was like... It was like, even though you were young, but it was still it wasn't what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. And there was something super magical about it then, that DJs would get paid and you'd just be happy with what you got paid.
Yeah, and it was like,
you just crack on with it. Now it's like...
crack on. It's like, I talk to people, you know, about it, and they look at me as if I'm talking about some mythical land that never existed. Mm. They're like, wow, you must have really got fucked up back in the day. I'm like, yeah, I did. Everybody did. But what I'm telling you is not exaggerated.
No.
If anything, it's not that I'm exaggerating anything. I actually can't even put into words how beautiful and amazing it was. I'm not over-exaggerating. I can't even, like, fathom or explain. Like how
amazing it was.
Yeah. You know, it's not some fabrication. It's like I'm dulling it, if anything, because I how do you explain that to somebody? You know? But people say to me, you know, if you could do it again, would you? And I'm like, no, fuck that. No, I wouldn't, you know, you do it right the first time, you're all good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I don't know. I don't know how I'm here sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, 11 of my friends from 2000 have killed themselves.
11?
Yeah.
That's you dark, know, people, man.
Close friends, you know, that have grew up in that scene.
Yeah.
And live that life, and reality sink in, and then like the reality part and struggle and you know, and that's like the hard consequences of some of it.
Yeah, I guess we all know that those a few people that just don't, they take the party too seriously. And it takes over their life. Like my parents, they own a drug and alcohol rehab. I used to work for them. I see it saw it every single day, where it would like start with the partying, and then something traumatic would happen, and then it just spirals, and it's just game over.
Yeah, it's you know, I speak to people on a, if not daily, you know, weekly, you know, talking a lot of people off the ledge. And you know, I kind of, through COVID, actually, I'd done all my life coaching courses. I just got my qualification from the ICF. Yeah, that's what I really was interested in going into and just having a part of my life.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people come to me for, to talk to me about stuff. You know,
yeah.
I deleted my Instagram a good while ago, and I rebuilt it again from just, I was like, what can I use my platform for? You know, I want to post less, but I want to connect more.
Totally.
On my posts, there's so many. I get more comments than I do likes.
Yeah.
It's fucking mad. Like, my stories are very truthful. They're very long.
Yeah.
But they connect with people, and people, not only do they reply with stories of their own, and then they're hitting me up in inbox, and I'm getting to see this other side of people, and it's a beautiful thing. And there's a lot of kind of confusion out there, a lot of questions, and I just kind of put myself in that kind of place for a lot of people. And I think that, especially through COVID and stuff like that, I was like, you know, I'm somebody that, one of the things I can say, okay, I do have this history. How can I use that more than worrying about being on a flyer? Like, how can I actually use my history?
Yeah.
Like, what things really matter and what things don't matter so much? Like, what things used to matter to me as my, for my ego?
Yeah.
And what parts of my life, scars and all, warts, can I use to actually be a fucking benefit? You know,
help,
like,
people.
Fuck the music and fuck the flyers and, you know, but what part of me is a benefit to actual the scene? Like, what can I do, you know? And that's been a huge thing.
I think there's something so special for it in everybody, though, is how good it makes you feel when you help somebody. And you can be given all the money in the world. You can do all the things you think you wanted to do. You can achieve all the goals that you think you wanted to, or all the goals that you set. Yet you start actually helping a few people with no, like, hidden agendas. And you generally just help somebody. And that feeling is better than anything.
It's, you're so true, mate, you know, and it's like, you just can't pay for that. Like, money doesn't buy that shit, you know. It's like, you know, I'm sure you get it all the time. People look at what you're doing and like, fucking hell, this guy's never going to talk to me, or blah, blah, blah. You connect with these people, and like, it's like you just give them a fucking record deal or something, you know what I mean? And
literally,
it's so like, and it ultimately, you know, we all get stuff from it, because it's like, takes us back into our youth and gives us the little reigniting, that little spark from memory, from remembering of being that in that position.
Totally. I still get it today. I still get it today. Like when I message you, like DM you and asking you to come on the podcast. Like when I speak to people that I've looked up to, or I've kind of at the beginning of my career where I've seen them as like much bigger artists than me, and much kind of achieve so much more than me, and kind of that's where I want to be, and now I'm playing the same lineups as them, and now I'm friends with them, and now, like, it is that thing, is that we as human beings, I can speak for everybody, I think, with here, we put people on pedestals, and not in a negative way, just that we look up to people. I think that's what we all strive in life. And then when you become good mates with them, and then you write a record with them, and then you're cooking dinner for them, and you're like, what the fuck is going on? And I think it's very, for me, with social media, and bringing this back around to social media from what you were talking about, I've always responded to every single comment. I've always responded to every single DM, because I know how important that is to people. And I've got so many friends that just can't be fucked. And for me, it's not even, there's career benefits. Of course there is. Responding to everyone is, there's career benefits. But the more out of that is that you might be somebody's favorite DJ. You might be somebody's favorite music producer. And the fact that they get to talk to you is literally making their day. And without sounding egotistical and taking that out of it, you're giving somebody the best feeling that they would never have had that day. And I think there's just something super magical about that.
Yeah, you're 100% right, mate. And what you're giving them is a realization, because you're so down to earth and you're connecting with them as a normal person, they're like, fuck, we're the same.
Yeah, we shit out the same hole.
I can do this. Yeah. I can fucking do this. You know what I mean? It's like, it's an incredible thing. It's an incredible thing. I'm sorry, mate. Sorry. It's my fucking...
No,
I set my alarm this week because I was hoping to get up at 11:30, and then I was like, I got in at 5 a.m. I was like, fuck, I forgot. I'm like, I've got fucking, well, I gotta
do this. Oh, shit. Sorry, man.
No, it's good. It's like, fuck, because we had to cancel it a couple of times and a couple of crazy weeks and stuff like that. But so that was my alarm. I'm sorry. It's so fucking rude. I didn't mean to.
Don't worry. It's all good. It's all good. I want to talk about the transition from UK to American scene. And kind of how that started, because I knew that you moved over here pretty early. I've always kind of like followed what you did, from the peripheries, and kind of, I knew that you came over to America and became a Vegas resident. How was that? Because 10 years ago, was that the EDM boom? Or was that the start of it?
Just the start of it, yeah. Before it was hard.
Yeah,
it was hard. I remember being in, like, so to paint the picture, Neil Moffat, who is a guy who created Hagasan Group, who created Omni, who created White Republic, he was my friend 25 years.
Wow.
He's a guy who had God's Kitchen. Mm. You know, I started working for him when I was 18. I actually started, the people who owned God's Kitchen before him, I started working for them when I was 16, when they used to have God's Kitchen in a place in Northampton called The Road Mender. Anyway, but he took it over 1998, 99, and I was their resident for a long time. Great friends. He started coming to America with me I started coming to America in 1998, actually. He started coming. He seen a huge market here that was untapped into in Vegas, and he stayed. He was coming back forward more often and developed this whole big culture, developed bottle service.
Yeah.
He was the first person to do it.
Wow.
And for years he was asking me to come, and I was on Radio 1, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I'm not fucking coming over there to play that fucking shit. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
It's fucking awful. There's no way. I mean, you know what I mean? At this point in time, I'm fucking, you know, Bayer's playing my records. Like, Coxie's fucking got my label, best label 3 years in a row. Lauren Garnier, Slat, like, I'm doing a lot of cool gigs, but, you know, at that point, I still had we can do this, you know, I'm making inroads, but at a certain point, I just couldn't get any further, and I just became really fucking tired, and I just couldn't shake the hard house pinup boy persona. No matter how hard it's fucking tried.
Well, you did it good. You did the hard house pinup persona guy good. You were that man.
I couldn't have fucking paid to be on any more magazines. like one of the only people ever to be on Mixed Mag cover fucking twice.
Yeah.
I was on, I was in the fucking back pages of the gay magazines as well. Boys fucking got the cocks out, and then there's a picture of me. That's fucking one of them up there. Like, so anyway, what happened was I tried really hard to really get into the techno world.
Yeah.
Kind of what happened at that time, what even let me play some techno was the techno that was around. I started playing like your Valentino Canzianis, Recycle Loops, your Umeg stuff, yeah. Marco Bielé. That stuff wasn't a million miles away from the BPM of the trance.
Yeah.
Right. So I was able to go and play it and Inside Out. I was able to go and play it in God's Kitchen. I was playing it in Scream and Bristol. Yeah. Like I was playing the Fire Station. I was playing a lot of techno there. Right. Mm. And what happened was when that techno, and I was playing it on Radio 1, all the techno guys fucking hated it. Like Ben Sims fucking hated me. Dave Clark, fucking, they all fucking hated me. But they would still come on and do my radio show.
Yeah.
But I knew they hated me, like, and it was fine. You know, I remember I even talked with Dave now. He came on my Radio 1 show, and on purpose, on his last track he played, he blew the fucking monitors up in the studio. He just fucking blew them up on purpose. Like, I was like, wow, that's so cool. Like. But these guys, they all fucking hated it. They didn't hate me as a person, I guess. They didn't like, I was the Antichrist. You can't go from hard house into techno world. That's not happening. No. Especially then. Mm. No one done what I done then. I downed my fucking tools and Ibiza. I got all the records out of my record box and said, I'm not playing that hard house ever again. And that's what happened. And that was a 10-year long journey of trying to break into the techno world. And it was hard as fuck. Because at one point, nobody wanted me. Mm. And so I was playing the techno in the kind of God's Kitchens and the Slinkies and the Scream and Bristol and stuff like that. But what happened was I was on the techno train, and because the techno I was playing became overground, let's use that word,
yeah.
All the other techno guys like Bear, they started making more minimal techno. Mm. And it got really plinkety-plunkety. And I kept going, following my techno vibe that I wanted, but the techno that they started making no longer fit it in the main rooms that I was doing them.
Yeah.
And I'm going playing headlining at God's Kitchen Global Gathering, and I'm playing like 124 BPM, and they're like,
what the fuck's this?
Yeah, they're like, you are fucking shit. Yeah. You're shit. Like, you're not playing here again. You just fucked that all up and back. And everybody hated me. Like, techno people hated me. Fucking all the other clubs hated me. Like, it was just a spiral. Like, I went in the DJ Mag Top 100, number 8. Every year, I think I fell 10 or 20 places after that. And it was like, it was a beautiful thing. I remember my mum calling me. She was like, you're not in the top 100 anymore. And I was like, thank fuck.
Yeah.
To me, that was the end of my hard house life. Yeah. And I was like, okay, now I can rebuild. Mm. And I was wrong, because it was fucking, I only went to a certain level. And I'm trying to get back to your question and give a little bit of backstory of the America thing.
Yeah.
You know, I just was tired of me. You know, I started doing my first tour when I was 16. And, you know, when I was 31, I decided to move here to America. I got offered a contract to play EDM. I remember being in the studio with Dave Robertson. I was in the studio with Dave every week, 3 days a week. I was to stay with him. And I'm like, I'm moving to America. This is the music I'm going to play. He's like, don't ever play that music in my studio. He's like, honestly, don't fucking. He's like, if you're making that music, like, don't ask me to make that music for it. Like,
it's not happening.
Friends, like, but I was like, it's good. Like, I couldn't, I just wanted to listen to it, see if I could play it. He's like, don't. So I remember going up into my bedroom and listening to it. And I was like, fuck, I don't know if I can play this music.
Yeah.
Don't know if I can play this music. And the only thing I could get around my head was I found a style in the EDM world that was called Melbourne Bounce.
Yeah.
And it was like Hard House.
Yeah, it's exactly the same as Hard House.
Yes, it was offbeat bassline. I was like, okay, that I can do.
Yeah.
I can connect to that on some level. And I remember coming over here and I was looking at everybody was coming to the club. And something I mentioned to you earlier, I had to transport myself back in time and look at people and go, okay, I am now a DJ.
Yeah.
I am now someone that is trying to be, look at and understand crowd psychology. What can I do to make this work for me as a DJ? What's the positives here? The positives were trying to immerse myself in this new scene, trying to understand what these young people wanted to listen to, you know, trying to understand there's maybe four or five different types of people in the room that maybe like hip hop, that there's older big spenders that want to hear 80s stuff. There's people that want to hear EDM. You know, there's people that will come up to you and say, have you got some techno? And I'm like, well, I've got fucking loads of techno. And not understanding that what they think techno is and what I think techno is two totally different things. Exactly. So for me, it was like, how can I make this work? Like, how can I make this work and really become egoless? And I'm talking about me, I'm not talking about any other DJs. How can I become an egoless DJ? How can I be there for the room completely? How can I play Bon Jovi, It's My Life? Or how can I play House of Pain, Jump Around? How can I, you know what I mean? How can I play Melbourne Bass? How can I play Avicii? How can I play all this stuff? You know, DMX up in here. And, you know, how can I put this all together? Because I don't really like this music. I can connect with it on a level because there's a vibe going on in the room. But for me as a very emotional person, it was hard for me and still is hard for me because the music for me, I'd feel it in my belly, it would go through my heart, and the music would make me put my hands in the air. Mm. You know, but that changed, and I had to tell myself, okay, 1, 2, 3. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's not that I'm trying to be disrespectful to the scene. I'm trying to be really honest and be like, how can I be the best DJ for these people?
Totally.
How can I be a good representation of what a good DJ is, no matter what the music is? How can I be the best DJ within all these genres, and how can I make it work? I don't want to stand up there and be and suck ass, be a fucking terrible DJ. I want to be a good DJ.
Totally.
I want to be able to master that. And, you know, this is a situation I put myself in, and I want to be great at it, you know, and, It was hard,
yeah,
you know, being on the microphone, you know, directing the club, and really feeling like a fish out of water. Mm-hmm. And fuck, I've been here 10 years now, you know, and my anxiety levels through that whole time were through the roof, mate.
Yeah,
you know, there was times when I was driving to work and I just wanted to crash my car into a fucking wall.
Yeah.
Not because I wanted to die, but because I wanted fucking time off. Mm. But I became so... not greedy, but I was like, take more work, more work. I was doing like 50 gigs when I first came. 2019, like I said, I was fucking contract was 340-something gigs.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, you know, playing that music that I'm not connecting with in my soul, but I'm being so present for everybody in there, and it's hard. Like, I had to stop listening to techno for all them years. My saving grace was when I met my wife. She got me into... classic rock, and that's what I listened to, and I researched the fuck out of it. I loved it.
Yeah,
I was like, because I couldn't listen to techno in the week, then go and play EDM at the weekend. I couldn't drive to work, listen to techno, and go and play. It was fucking wrecking my head. So I just had to be all into it. I had to take any fucking techno off my USBs, like,
wow.
And I just had to be all in. And people, I was getting the, you know, they had all the Facebooks like, Ferg, what are you doing? You totally sold out. And they're giving me all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. For the first time in my life, I took a job. Yeah. It's a job.
But that was, That was the thing that was going on in my head, was that what we were talking about with having a real job, that's doing 225 shows a year. That's a real job.
It's a job, yeah. It was a job. It was like, I learned more about DJing being in Vegas than I've learned anywhere.
I bet.
You know, there's something to be said for going to a techno party and playing techno. Okay, what are you going to play? I'm going to play techno. Okay, great. I'm not saying it's easier or it's harder. I'm just saying it's different. Going into a nightclub in Vegas, you know, you got somebody coming up going, we're going to spend $100,000 if you fucking play, what's the theme song to Rocky?
Yeah.
Survivor.
Yeah.
And you got to play it. I'm like, fuck me, how the fuck am I going to put that on? You know, and it's like half the people in the club are grassroots EDM people. They're so into this EDM that they think I'm really on coke because I'm fucking putting on, it's the Eye of the Tiger. They're like, what is this guy doing? And I'm like, I'm saying to myself, what the fuck are you doing? And it's like, it's a constant head fuck, you know, and it's you're constantly trying to figure it out. And it's been fucking one of the hardest things I've done.
Mm.
One of the hardest things I've done. And, but it's one of the, you know, I've come out the other side of it, and I'm of a different perspective on life, of a different perspective on DJing, of a different appreciation for DJing. You know, I'm getting to do gigs. I'm fucking playing with Damien Lazarus. I'm fucking doing Rufus the Soul and who I'm fucking Saturday night, Monday I'm playing with fucking Gordo and Dubfire. Obviously a pipe of Coxie on Sunday night, and I'm getting to do all these things. If you had said to me that this would have been possible,
I know, right?
I was like, not a chance.
Yeah.
Not a chance. It's never happened. No one is doing all them different styles at that level. It's mad, man.
Yeah.
It's mad.
It's and go on, carry on.
Just to say that it's mad, and I don't expect everybody to get it. I find it hard getting it. If you don't get it, it's cool. It's fine. You know, I'm a person. You're a person. I'm trying to figure this all out as I go along. And I'm, first and foremost, I'm a DJ. And I'm trying to be the best DJ I can be for wherever I play. Trying to understand all these different styles of music. Like, I will, on a Thursday night, play open format. Then on Friday night, I'm playing Black Coffee, and I'm playing beautiful 120 BPM Afro House, which is like the most earthy, organic, fucking emotional music I've ever played in my fucking life. Like, and going from that, when you're really connecting from the fucking bottom of your fucking soul to these people in the nightclub, to them playing on a Saturday night when you're taking your soul out of it and you're being present for them.
Yeah.
It's a minefield. It's emotional.
It's really interesting because it's, you're being a classic resident DJ.
Yeah.
Which used to be a thing years ago, and it stopped for a long time. And it still isn't there, but I feel like what you're describing, you are being kind of the classic resident DJ, where the resident DJ doesn't, it is about the people. And it's about creating a atmosphere for the people so that they have the best time. And whether that's creating an atmosphere for the people, for then somebody else to come on and play after, or it's for you to kind of keep the people in the club, or whether it's for you to think business-minded for the club, is like, well, we're in Vegas, we need people to spend money in here, and we kind of, we're, without sounding disrespectful, we can be a bit of a jukebox for them, because if somebody's offering us $100,000, then we're going to fucking take it.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's exactly, it's, you are being a jukebox. I don't mind the term. I like the term. Mm. People get all busted up in Vegas, no requests. Let me tell you this here. If somebody wants to come, if they fucking really want to hear a song, and it's going to make their night, and I can fit into myself. I'll play it.
Yeah.
Why would I? You know, if someone give me a fucking list, if they went round the club and give me a list of fucking 20 songs and 20 people who would absolutely beg to play, I'd fucking play them.
Yeah.
Of course I would. You know, it's one of the biggest hurdles that I had to get over was being kind of egoless and being like, I'm being employed by the club to not, I don't have to bring people into the club.
No.
I don't have to. My job, that is not my job. My job is to keep the people in the club. Mm. You know, it's like my job is to set it up for, if I'm playing for, whether it's Calvin, whether it's Black Coffee, or it's Damien Lazarus, whoever it is, my job is to keep them in there. Yeah. You know what I mean? Obviously, I headline here as well, and it's the same thing, but it depends what, you know, music I'm playing. Like, I played at Encore Beach Club on Wednesday night, and I fucking played techno all night. That's what they booked me to play. They're like, for, you know, like, so just to point out, I'm doing two different names. Like, when I first came to America, I went under the name Rob Gasson to play a lot of the EDM stuff because I didn't know if I was going to be able to stay. Because I don't know if I can fucking stand this music.
Yeah.
So I'd done that for a while, and then when I stayed, I just was like, I'll just do everything as Fergie. And then last year, I was actually going to give up DJing. And my wife was like, why don't you just play music that you love? And I was like, fuck, I never thought of that. Because I've been in this game here for 10 years. And I made Alpha Centauri, and then I just started making music again. And I was like, okay, well, I'll keep Fergie for kind of more techno stuff and do the other thing again. And that's where I'm at. But it's like, it's a constant kind of Fergie kind of evolution. And if you look at, like you said at the start, Liz, when we first started talking, it's definitely not the normal route.
No, not at anybody. All.
It's the absolute opposite. I don't think there's anybody that's done, been on the same journey that mine has been. Mm. And the hardest part has kind of been being able to accept myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, because you're the person that has to look at yourself in the mirror every day. And there's nobody else. You can walk away from a club, you can walk away from everything, like you, but you still have to be able to sit with yourself and look at yourself in the mirror and go, this is who I am.
Yeah, it's like if I no matter what set I play, like whether it's open format, whether it's EDM, or it's, you know, fucking techno, or it's afro or whatever. If it's, the set is either amazing or it's not. That's what it is for me. Like, it either really connected or it didn't. You know, like, I very, very critical about the delivery.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, people say, well, in Vegas, you just play all the hits. Okay, yeah, it's a large part of it, but no club you're ever going to be to is going to keep their fucking hands in the air all fucking night. So how do you maintain that? How do you play the hits but not tire people out? And how do you not burn the fucking DJ before? Because there's a lot of crossover stuff. You know, it's the fucking hardest DJ job I've had.
Mm.
You know, and people are like, hey, you know, have you ever played in Ibiza? You know, or like, you're really good. You know, and when I first came over here, you know, people were saying stuff like that, and I always had the bit of, had, you know, had the ego. And I remember I was playing on the Terrace, nightclub called Pure. I'm playing like fucking housey stuff, like old affected stuff. At that point, I still was trying to not let go of playing some good music. And I was playing all that, and a guy came up to me and goes, yeah, you're really good. Have you ever heard of Tiesto? I was like, did Tiesto used to fucking be my opener DJ? He's like, wow, man, what went wrong? And I was like, from that moment on, I was like, I'm never fucking mentioning the band. Because he was fucking right. He was so right. And he didn't even mean to be a smart ass. He wasn't being a smart ass. Just complete honesty. What went wrong? I was like, fuck me.
Well, at least you can laugh about it, because I don't actually think anything went wrong. I think I'm a true believer that we make our own paths and we end up where we're at some point in our life for some reason. And I think what you've created, you have been one of the driving forces of music in Vegas now. And you have allowed many people to have the best time of their lives in Vegas. And you've also, in your Fergie hard house years and techno years, you also did that as well. So I think in the grand scheme of things, you've fucking smashed it.
Well, you know, to be able to, play the music that you love and understand it's not for everybody, and everybody has their like I say, their image of what suits their brand.
Yeah.
I'm no longer offended if my brand doesn't suit their brand. I understand the path I've taken. I understand the gigs that I've taken. I cannot be offended that they're offended. You know what I mean? They're offended. Like, it's so, like, if it doesn't fit their brand, it doesn't fit their brand.
Totally.
It's the same way of someone, I'm playing EDM and they say, can you play a Dubfire track? And I don't think it's going to work. It's going to, you know what I mean? I'm not going to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so if what I'm doing doesn't suit everybody, and I'm not going to, get on all these, you're not going to be seeing me on all these fucking uber cool flyers and stuff. And sometimes I have to take a back seat and just do the gig and not be on there. And that's fine.
Take one for the team. Yeah. Yeah. I guess the thing that also with Vegas is how house music or electronic music has kind of become fashionable over the years and how it's evolved from EDM to now Black Coffee's has a residency, or I think Jamie had a residency at some point over there. And
he's here Saturday, and Corolla's here on Saturday, and exactly. It's seeing that evolution, which I've been a part of.
Yeah.
I've been lucky to be a part of it. I've been lucky, even if it's like, the club at the end of the night, they would say to me, Ferg, after the headliner, they'd be like, okay, we want to close up, play some of your old shit that you used to make. I'm like, really? Like, they're like, yeah, put some of that on.
That's such a classic bar club manager kind of vibe that they just don't have. Like, fucking
about some boring techno shit you used to make. Yeah, that'll clear it out pretty quick.
Boring techno shit.
Yeah. And that would be the only time I get to play it. I'm like, yeah, I'm loving it, But the one of the biggest changes, Calvin.
Yeah.
Calvin was smashing out the techno, man. He was just like fucking playing hard as fuck.
Yeah.
But he was doing it in a cool way. He was doing a lot of the mashups, A lot of, he has to play his hits.
Of course he does.
But he was playing some fucking really cool fucking shit. And it was before he started doing the Love Regenerator stuff, but Alvin really, he brought a lot of cool music here. The interesting with that was all the girls were staying on the podiums and dancing to it. And I would just, even when I was working, I'd go and just listen to him. And he was like, do you think they like it? I was like, fucking right, mate. Fucking hammer the fuck out of it. So he was going for it, So he was a big part in it, because these people were guided by, as we all were, as, the DJ. And if it takes someone to be able to stand up and play stuff like that. So, and he did. He did. And, we've seen the growth of, the more kind of, say, underground stuff here. We've had MK here. We have the Camelphat guys, Peggy Go. We've had everybody, Fitzpatrick. Yeah. Everybody's coming through here now, and it's brilliant. And I'm very fortunate that I get to have a little small piece of it, and I can do my job that my my residencies I'm very proud of. I take a lot of fucking pride in it. I spend a lot of time doing my music and getting my sets ready. And then I get to have my little moment where I play what I'm fucking so passionate is a part of my fucking life. Massive way. You know, it's like, it's just, you just can't fucking put it into words. It's like, you know, talking about social media again, you know, it's been a huge part being able to explain myself. You know, when I was doing interviews back in the day, the only information that came out about when I changed music was what the journalist wrote. But now I'm able to talk people through it. I'm able to speak to people and people get it. They're like, do you know what? Fucking go for it, Ferg, man. You know, it's like,
This is why I love doing the podcast as well, because there's so much, like, you and I would never have spoken about this if we hung out. Like, there'd be stories, there'd be a few things kicking about, but we generally just talk about this general shit, right? We wouldn't have ever have spoken about everything that we've spoken about today. And by us speaking about this today, other people can hear that and be like, fuck, it's...
You know, it's like, you know, I have to appreciate as well, you know, when people are annoyed, it's because they're so passionate about their scene. And I can't take that away from them either. I can't say, you're a fucking cop for saying I'm a cop. You know what I mean? Because you're saying it because you're so defensive about, I love techno. This is my heart. This is my soul. Good. I'm glad you feel that way about it. I'm glad you feel that way about it. Happy days. I don't fit into your thing and that's fine. You know what I mean? But good on you. Stick up for what you fucking believe. Like, totally. You know, that's what gives us our scene.
100%. You know, it's authentic. You know what I mean? It's being authentic to yourself and who you are and the people around you. And I think as long as you allow other people to have their opinions,
They have to.
And you're allowed to, I think closed-mindedness is pretty dangerous to a certain extent when it comes to anything, especially when it comes to music. Like, one of my friends sent me a record yesterday and I knew I was going to dislike it a lot. I'd already told myself I was going to dislike it, but I still listened to it and was like, yeah, I understand why you like this. It's still shit, but I understand.
I'm the same, mate. I'm the same. Yeah. You know, I'm the same. And I expect the same from
everybody else.
People. I send stuff to you. It's trying to get people's attention though when you're sending them music now is fucking hard as fuck.
I think this is where it's changed a lot, and I've noticed this in the last 5 years for me. And especially over COVID. Not everyone's DJing, and there's not as many people DJing at all. Although it looks like all the DJs are back, there's so many DJs that aren't back. And the way the scene's changed with streaming as well, I feel like there's a lot more like even with me, I will only play records that I've either made or my close mates send me. And I'm like, I fucking love this record. I very rarely go and hunt for music. I just find it so degrading to myself because it's so hard to find music that I really like. Just the way there's so, I know, and I, that's very naive of me to say, because there's insane music out there that I know I'm not getting my hands on. But I've just kind of just made my world a bit smaller, and maybe I should kind of open up a little bit, but for me, it's just like, it works. And I feel like there's a lot of people that have done the same. Like, I was having a conversation with my label team yesterday, and we were talking about how, can you remember, like, for years, it always mattered what DJs responded on your promos, right? Or it was always like a big thing. That's now, big deal. It means fuck all now. It means fuck all. What really matters is if you've got a video of a DJ playing it. Because then you can tell people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just changed. And I don't think it's changed in a negative way. It's just different.
I think we're talking about what you were saying with the streaming thing. One of the biggest things noticing is that I think, in a way, people are not searching for artists as much as they were. Like, they're having these playlists created and they're listening to these playlists. And if they like a playlist, that means that the playlist is being updated and they don't have to search for music that they like because they just search for the name of a playlist.
Yep.
And they don't have to go any further than the playlist because they trust that playlist, whether it's chill vibes or whatever it may be. And that's all they're interested in knowing. And, you know, when we were growing up, first of all, we knew that every artist that we were playing, every record was in your collection. Mm. And now there's so much stuff now. Like, I have to do playlists in my record box or it gives me anxiety because there's so much stuff you can play. I need to put it into some sort of order. I'm like, fuck me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Limitations, for me, limitations create the best creativity. And it goes back to vinyl days for me. And I still DJ almost how I would on vinyl. I'm very like a visual person. So I don't remember tracks by their name or artist. I remember tracks by the artwork. And it's one of the reasons I always travel with all my music. My USB stick has, I DJ off a hard drive and it has pretty much all my music from 2014 to now. It has everything on. And the limitations that I set myself, though, is I might get some record. I might go into go to a club with like 5 new records, and that's it. And everything else is either going to be records that's not released from friends, or my own records that are released or aren't released. And that's how I, for me, as a DJ, kind of make a bit more of a unique set for everybody, because a lot of these records they've never heard before and they're probably never gonna get released, so it means that they can only come and see me play it.
Your sets, you know, your sound's unique to you anyway, for sure. There's nobody really making stuff.
But I guess also going back to that streaming thing, can you remember when we used to buy records in vinyl shops and then you'd build like a relationship with your with the like vinyl seller, and they were almost like the Spotify playlist makers.
Yeah, totally.
Where you'd walk in and they'd pull under the desk and be like, oh, I've got like 20 records for you. And it's like, and then they talk you through it. It's just changed. And but I think the amazing thing, there's a lot of things about streaming that I really dislike. And it really grinds my gears on a daily basis, and it's frustrating as fuck. But it has opened the world to our music tenfolds.
Yeah, it's, I'm assuming, you know, there's a lot of positives for it, and there's a lot of stuff you have to kind of, you know, grit your teeth.
Yeah.
And, but being able to, you know, being able to strip everything back to, you know, the foundation of what you do on all these instances, you know, whether it's getting your name on the flyer. Okay, well, why do you want your name on the flyer? What were you doing before your name was on the flyer? Yeah. Well, I was just DJing in my bedroom. Okay, do that. You know, with regards to streaming, okay, cut away all the bullshit. What are you getting from a streaming? I'm getting my music into the ears of millions. And just having to reassess and ask different questions, because this world that we're in now is, we've not asked ourselves these questions in many ways. You know, it's a new world. You know, it's such a many different, so many different ways to look at stuff. And I think if we keep kind of evolving and asking ourselves different questions and trying to be honest with ourselves and, you know, keep it interesting and find new ways to fucking not only survive but thrive and Yeah,
man, I agree. I think we've just done an hour and 50 minutes. That's
an hour and 50?
Yeah. It's just flown by, man. I feel like we could keep going for hours. Mate, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to sit down and kind of listen to what you've achieved over the years. It's pretty amazing. Before we go, how can people follow you? How can people kind of be part of Fergie life?
Firstly, thank you for having me on, man. I absolutely love the podcast. It's the realest one there is. Like, I don't even read kind of many interviews or stuff like that anymore. Like, I kind of, you know, so I get my information here. It's kind of raw in parts and real. Carnage was a prime example of that.
That's a good one.
A great one. How can people follow me? Yeah, Fergie DJ, fucking Instagram. All the info's up there. Sick. Like, I don't post loads. Facebook.
You got any music coming out?
I have got a new track coming out in May called Testify on Our Mind.
Nice.
Yeah. I've actually done a remix of, do you remember Igor S. Boomerang?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, big Fergie track back in the day. I've done a mix of that. I've done a mix of Storm Time to Burn. I've done that a lot. More of on the techier side than the big room stuff that I've been doing. And I'll probably make some Afro stuff next, just to see
what happens. That black coffee shit.
I absolutely love it.
I tell you what I've been listening to is the Ramper and Me album stuff. Like,
that's so good.
It's driving music for me. I don't know if I can really play it. I can't play it. I can play it in my sets. And I'm playing in Miami next week, and I'm actually opening and then closing. So it's like I get to, like, the opening set, I'm going to get to play it. But it's, like, so nice to listen to.
That's so good.
Absolutely.
Should listen to a guy called Sippy from Barcelona.
Okay. Insane.
It's like just so emotive music, but intense, but really serious, but really cool, and just fucking.
I need to check that out. Dude, thank you for coming on, man. Big love.
Really appreciate it, man. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, man. I'm in Vegas in May, so hopefully we can. Hopefully we can catch up.
Happy days.
Come and party. I don't know if it's not been announced yet, but it's like a pre-EDC party.
Okay.
I'll
be 100%. Be great to. I'd really actually like you to come here and cook for me.
I'd happily do that.
Yeah, my wife cooks. I'm so spoiled. She'll cook like something new every lunch, something new every night. And like, I'm so fucking spoiled.
You can you cook?
No. I made her a fucking cheese and ham toasty once. That.
Classy. She's a lucky girl.
Yep, there you go.
Mate, keep safe. Keep in touch. And thank you, man.
Thank you so much.
Peace. All right, see you in a bit. And that is a wrap. Thank you for listening. Big love to Fergie for coming on. Please subscribe. Send it to your mates. Give us some comments below. Let me know what you think. Keep safe. See you soon.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you're ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.